Welcome to the Joseph Campbell Audio Collection. This talk is called The Vitality of Myth. It is the fifth selection in the series entitled Mythology and the Individual. And now, Joseph Campbell.
The title of the series that I'm lecturing on is Civilization and Its Discontents. And since my own special passion is mythology, I have the feeling that one of the great reasons for the discontents is the failure in vitality of the myths by which people are being expected to live. It was some 65 or so years ago that Dr. Jung, after completing the work that has been translated under the title Symbols of Transformation, and having worked while laboring on that through a great mass of mythological material, came to this thought: what is the myth that I am living by? He said, I realized when I finished this what a thing it was to live with a myth, and what a thing it is to live without one. And he said, I proposed to myself the discovery of the myth that I was living by as my task of tasks. So one can ask, what has happened that so many today are living without a myth? Many perhaps may feel that they are living with a myth, the myth of whatever the religion is that they have been brought up in or have chosen to make their own. But there's something essentially incongruous about archaic mythologies in the modern world. There has been such a tremendous transformation of life and of the laws for living and of the environment that we are in, that none of the older traditions can possibly have the impact on us today that they had when first offered. Mythologies, after all, are the product of poetic insight and inspiration, and the insight properly should be congruent with the world in which the people are living, to whom the mythology or imagery is addressed. Consider one of the principal characteristics of our mythologies. I'm thinking of the biblical mythology, whether of the Hebrew or the Latin Christian traditions. The characteristic of these mythologies, the mythology of the Bible, is that the imagery of myth is in these interpreted as having historical reference. The real reference of mythology is to the spirit, to the psyche, right in here. The way a society grips its members and holds them to the tasks of the society is by enabling people to project their own inward mythic potentials into the context of the society in which they're living. But when the context of the society has changed, then we need a new mythology. The same great themes, because there are permanent, universal themes, which are the base, the ground of all mythological lore. But these themes then have to be related to an environment in which the individual is living. Now, the characteristic of our biblical mythology is that all of its images ask you to believe in them as though they had happened physically. It's as though they were newspaper reports, chronicles of things that happened. And then when scholarship today finds that these things could not have happened, and indeed did not happen, what happens to the mythology? It is removed. It is discredited, so that the word myth today to most people means a lie. And that's because our myths are, in a certain sense, lies, in that they ask us to believe factually, concretely, what is not true. Now, when this happens, the mythology is taken away. But the function of a mythology is to integrate one's conscious life with the dynamics of one's unconscious life, and with the mythological vocabulary taken away by which the consciousness communicated with the unconscious, we are, as it were, split apart. And a schizophrenic crack-up is the result of a consciousness that has lost its grip in the conscious world because the energies that kept it there became involved and stuck in the unconscious, and there's no communication, and the person slips down into the abyss. Now, Jung, in his early years as a psychiatrist, was in the Berghölzli Sanatorium in Zurich working with schizophrenics. Freud had as his principal clientele, you might say, neurotics. A neurotic is a person who is still in the conscious world and is in relationship to his unconscious in a rather desperate way. But a psychotic is one who is cracked off altogether. And he's down in that realm of the mythic archetypal forms. And Jung was completely acquainted with the, you might say, atmosphere and scenery of that domain. And he found it was the same as the domain of myth. When people, it's not as fashionable now as it was a couple of years ago, find themselves taking LSD suddenly out, they have brought forth an unconscious load that their consciousness could not handle, they too slip into that domain. This is the domain of mythic images. It lives in us. It's good to be acquainted with it. And when a mythology with which we are living does not operate on us, we lose this contact. Now, what did Jung do when he asked himself what myth he was living by? He had been interpreting people's dreams. He suddenly realized one does not interpret dreams. One lets the dreamer interpret the dream because there is no single vocabulary, no dictionary of dream images. Each person's dream is his own in a certain way. There's one level of dream then that is personal. These are the little dreams. But then every now and then there comes bursting forth a dream that is not personal at all. The dreamer has struck a level that has been struck before by others, a level of the basic human confrontations with life and its mysteries. The human being is the only animal in the world that knows it's going to die. The confrontation with death, the meaning of life in the face of death, does it have a meaning? And if the mind goes looking for meanings, and you're living by meanings, and have never learned simply to live by being, you may be greatly upset by the challenge of death. Another challenge that the animals do not face is that of the cosmos. And with the amplification of our knowledge of the cosmos, what we have to be related to by our mythology is the cosmos in which we are living now. This is why, for me, in the present context of life, the moonwalk, and I've said this before to Cooper Union audiences, is the great event. It has eliminated publicly for the world a whole context of archaic mythologies that do not serve us anymore. But it has not worked only negatively in canceling what was. It has opened the poetic prospect of an experiencing of the cosmos as it now can be experienced. I'm going to repeat a couple of thoughts, because they seem to be important, that I put into that myths to live by in this context. That first moment when that first foot came down on the moon, it was a long time ago now, curiously, but this was quite a moment. And the Italian poet Giuseppe Ungaretti wrote a poem to this moment. The Italian magazine Epoca showed a picture of him, a wonderful little old man, pointing with great excitement at the screen of the TV set that was bringing this picture thousands, tens of thousands of miles to his room. And he said, there never was a night like this before in the history of the world. The thing that strikes me is that scientists in Houston, Texas, knew exactly how much energy to put into those rockets to bring them in a course that could be predicted around a space that no one had ever visited before. This makes vivid a problem that Kant asks in his Introduction to Metaphysics. How is it that the geometrical calculations that I make in this space here will certainly work in that space there? How is it that the space field is so consistent that one can be certain, with apodictic certainty, the calculations made here will also work there? It was known exactly how much energy to put into those machines, exactly what direction to pitch them in, to bring those young men back within a mile of the boat that was waiting for them in the Pacific Ocean. And yet no one knew how deep the dust was going to be on the moon when that foot descended. Space is something that lives in our mind, and it's the same space in our mind as it is out there. We have, as it were, all space within us. All of the earlier mythologies saw the moon and the planets and the sun and the stars as representing a different order of being altogether from that of the earth. We were a coarse, material world. That was a world of luminous energy and light. Now we know absolutely that the same laws work there as work here. There are not two worlds there. Furthermore, the deities that were thought to live up there, we now know have been projected from our own psyches out onto that space. So that everything that we attributed to the gods and to the yonder spiritual world comes right out of our own selves, and it's right here. And man was not breathed into the earth. Man came out of the earth. And the earth came out of a galaxy, and the galaxy came out of space. We are, as it were, sitting here and standing here. The organs of consciousness of the very earth itself, that's what we've come from, as a flower comes from a stem. And so out of space, the earth has come. And out of the earth, we have come, with a consciousness to know the world. But what we are to know and what we have inside are exactly congruent. This gives a totally new pitch to the accent, a new focus to the mystery of being. It's right here now. This is an old story, really. It's been said time and time again by others. You will find it in the Upanishads, the 9th century B.C. Worship this god. Worship that god. One god after another. Where is the creator of the gods? The creator of the gods is one's own self. Look to yourself and follow it as you would follow the footsteps of a lost cow. By following those, you will find the source of the gods. There's a precisely similar line in the Egyptian Book of the Dead. The soul of the dead is called Osiris because it is one with the ultimate being of the universe. And there comes a moment when, in the chapter on the opening of the mouth, we read, I am yesterday, today, and tomorrow. I have the power to be born a second time. I am the source and creator of all the gods. This is an old theme that has come back again in a new sense. And meanwhile, there have been what might be called exoteric popular mythologies telling us that the gods are out there, that they created us from clay, they created us to be their servant, we are to obey and to serve them. On the contrary, they are the projections of our own consciousness, and we are to burn them up if we can't use them, and bring forth others that are good for today. It's an old story, too. So what did Dr. Jung do? He thought, what was it I enjoyed most when I was a boy? That was the time when you were spontaneously living out your own dream, your own fun. The world had not pushed in on you. And he recalled that he had liked to build little cities of stones. And so he bought a piece of property and began building a house of stone with his own hands. And as he was doing that, putting the stones here and there, his fantasy world began developing. And so he began writing out his fantasies. Not as you would write a work intended for others to see, rather corny stuff. But it's what comes slopping out at first. And then it became richer and deeper, and he began to draw pictures of the figures that were coming. Then he began to find that these pictures that he was drawing were comparable to the great religious pictures of the Orient, the mandalas. He was the first to start working on his own mandalas. And very soon discovered that through the realm of myth, of dream rather, he was himself moving into the sphere of myth. This gave him a basic principle for a psychological work. And I think it's one that we can all live with. He calls it amplification. Amplify your own fantasies by finding in the field of the cultural heritage of mankind analogous images. And these will pull you out. They will depersonalize your life. And that is what the function of myth is. Now, I was reading shortly before coming here a work by Abraham Maslow, a wonderful psychologist, a very important psychologist, one whom I most delight in reading. And he was speaking of what he called a hierarchy of values for which people live. And the hierarchy was as follows. Survival, security, personal relationships, and self-development. Fortunately, I was reading those only a day or so ago, and then I began thinking of this lecture today, and I went back to those, and I thought, well, those are exactly the values that have nothing to do with mythology. Mythology is the law of giving yourself, losing yourself. A person who lives by a myth is fascinated by an aspiration for which he will sacrifice security, for which he will sacrifice even his life, for which he will sacrifice friends and everything else. The myth-driven person is in some sense a kind of fanatic. The fanatic actually, however, is a rather raw type. He is not seasoned in the field. He's like a convert to a new religion. He's all just so full of it, he doesn't know how to integrate it with life. He's a kind of sophomore. You know this one, where the idea has overloaded the mind and the person is blown. And it doesn't take much of an idea to blow some people. Myth, then, is what comes out of a transpersonal dimension of your own life. And the big problem, after it has struck you, is to integrate it back into life. Now, I know that in our world today, there's a great, great zeal for self-exploration, turning inward, and meditation. And I have seen some rather bad results because it has made the person too much interested in him or herself. And the person forgets others. Old Paul Tillich once said that one's God is one's highest concern. That's your true God, that which you would die for, that which you would sacrifice for. And if you sacrifice others for yourself, for your own development, then what would you say was your God? In a marriage, for example, you have to ask yourself, what in this marriage is the precious thing? Is it I, or is it the marriage? If it's not the marriage, then you're not married yet. One result of meditation very often is that it introverts the person to such an extent that the person separates from the one to whom he had committed himself before. I've seen many marriages go on the rocks this way. Now, the problem that all of the great masters give us is that of finding the inward way and holding to the outer way. This is a formula that the old Sufis worked out in the following way. They spoke of wearing the outer garment of the law. That is to say, the order of the society in which one is living, and wearing the inner garment of the mystic way. Now, in order to find the inner garment, you have to take off the outer garment and let it go. There's a long season, very often, of inward turning this way and throwing the world away. But unless you can put the other garment back on again, you haven't really come to the sophistication that lets you know that this is that and that is this. That this outer garment is the outer reflection of the same laws and principles that you're finding within, so that you should be at ease somehow in the two worlds. This is an old mythological story. Now let me just say a word about mythology and civilization. One of the marvelous experiences in travel, of course, is to come into a new mythological province. One goes to Japan. Everything there has grown out of a mythology that is different from the one that you grew out of. And you get the flavor, the quality of this in every detail of the life. Mythologies shape civilizations. Every civilization on the face of the earth has been shaped by a mythology. And the people who live in that world live in the atmosphere of myth. I noticed when I was in India, the squalor, the horrible poverty, you can't believe it. It goes far beyond anything that our words refer to here. and yet a curious quality of peace and even bliss. Why? Because those people are accepting and living in a myth that supports them. A religious person who has experienced a terrific calamity, everything ripped away, comes home and finds, let's say, the home burned down and the children burned and everything else. How does one survive a thing like that? That'll let you know what your myth is. The religious person can very well say, it's God's will, and I've seen that happen. And such a person can survive an experience that another would not have survived. Now, what is it that you survive on? What is the support of your life? What would hold you up in a thing like that? When I tell people, they ask, you know, what is it you're interested in? I say, mythology. They say, oh, yes, I read Bullfinch. I thought he was loving my day. I said, well, I'm interested in Bullfinch, but do you believe in God? Well, you know, 95% of the people in the United States believe in God. I read that in France, 35% believe in God, but 60% believe in hell. Now, I can't work that out. Except that France is the place, you know, of the existentialists for whom life is hell. And whenever the concierge or your the hotel servant speaks to you, they say, la vie est dure. And so life is tough there. And they believe in hell, but not in God. That's a great one. Well, this is a question to ask. And the God that you believe in, is it a personal God? Well, no. Well, then it's transpersonal power. Yes. Is it mental? You know, a great intelligence. This is a grand idea that a lot of people have. Great intelligence. Doesn't look so non-intelligent to me. Just because it's orderly, it's stupid. A great Irishman, Scotus Erigena, who said the quality of God is that he doesn't know what he's doing. And it's just a drive of the will. And he finds out, and that's the job of the sun, you and me. Because what we are is the incarnation of the sun, the knower, and the degree to which we're capable of knowing the ultimate measures the degree of our approach to ultimate godhood, which can be pretty close. You can get there pretty close and still look sort of young and fresh and enjoying things. So we have the civilizations growing out of mythologies, and these are mythologies that convince the people within them that they're finding their fulfillment within the world in which they are dwelling. Now, something happened to our world a little while ago. Let's think what the old medieval myth was, which really was the life of the medieval civilization, so that people between the year 1150 and 1250 built most of the great cathedrals in Europe. They put everything they had into that absurd task. Mythology asks for absurd tasks. Think of the Egyptian pyramids. The economic interpretation of history just doesn't confront the pyramids. And that was the beginning. In fact, the economic concern is the ego concern with survival and all that, which is the non-mythological concern, and it has never built a civilization. It has never built a cathedral. What builds the civilization in the cathedral is a mad aspiration of some kind. And as long as that lasts, people are pulling together. And if you don't have an aspiration, then the only other thing that will pull people together so they'll do something is fear. Either aspiration or fear, and then people will work together. But let them not be scared and not have something crazy pushing them. They're just then thinking of survival and security and you know what else.